It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Well, that started off a wonderful 2006 because you had four more wins after that, winning the Michelob at King's Mill. Another walk in the park by seven over Lorena and he won Han. The Avion Masters, you could point to as another one that you're just before your time, but you won the 2006 Avion Masters by one over Laura Davies and Michelle Wee. That didn't become a major until 2013. I'm sure you wished it had.
Yeah, I do. I think, the evolution of Avion becoming a major, I think when I won it in 2006, it had always been a special event. Even prior to it being an LPGA event, Frank Ribaud and Avion had always tried to elevate the women's game, even from the very first year. I think 94 was the first year it was played, and I played it in 95 in my rookie year, and a couple of times after that, prior to it becoming an LPGA event. So, every year Frank raise the purse to compete with the US Open, and it forced the USGA to raise their purses so that they remained the highest purse in women's golf. So Frank had done a lot for women's golf, and winning that event, although I never saw it becoming a major, it was always a big event on our schedule, and it was always one of the biggest purses on our schedule. So I think players, wanted to win it as much as they wanted to win a major, because it was worth more than two or three of our other majors.
After the Avion Masters, win the long drug challenge, where you beat Annika Sörenstam again. The Mizuno Classic, four shots over Karai Higo. Is that right? Do I pronounce that right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. There was a couple of Higos that played on the JLPGA.
But quite a career.
Thank you, Bruce.
You get through that year 2006. Where are you at? Because you're still fairly young. We haven't heard about any injuries, and so you must have been healthy. What was going through your mind at that point?
Obviously, 2006 ranks up there with one of my best years of my career. Sure. I think, coming from sort of being low on confidence heading into the year, I think it's a very special year because, it showed me that one shot, the shot that I hold, at Dinosaur, was a catalyst to a great year. And so I went from really, not feeling great about the prospects of the year to then going on to having one of the best years of my career. So, it was a great learning experience. And Mike, as you mentioned, as far as injuries go, I've been very, very lucky in my career. I've never missed any playing time due to injuries.
That's great.
Yeah. I've never withdrawn from an event for injury. The schedule I've set for the year has been played, at almost 100%, if not 100%, very, very healthy. So, I think I did some good work to create that, but I think there's a definite element of luck and good fortune to have made it through my career without missing playing time for injury.
Yeah, you see some fairly fit players that it's made just one shot in a wrong kind of lie, and boom, something happens.
Yeah, I think too. The younger players today are growing up in an era where speed and power is hugely important in the golf swing, and it's placing at young ages, it's placing enormous amount of pressure on their bodies. And I think, we're seeing the toll that's taking on their bodies now. You only have to look at, a Nelly Korda, I think she's had maybe one year where she's played injury free, and she's only 22 or 23 or whatever Nellie is. You know, I think girls and guys, you know, focusing on golf at younger and younger ages and making it their only sport to start with. So your body's just training one-dimensionally for long, long times and for many, many years, even before you become a professional golfer. You know, I think it's showing that it's taking the toll on players' bodies.
And we've heard a lot of your peers make that same comment about wishing that the players were better rounded, playing different sports, developing their complete body. And then the other difference we see, as you mentioned, golf, much like baseball pitching, has gone from being a, in the case of baseball, you used to be able to pitch, now you're throwing. In other words, it's a maximum effort sport as a pitcher. It didn't used to be that when you had a sweet spot in golf the size of the top of a pencil head. You couldn't go at it 130 miles an hour.
Right. Yeah, you're definitely right. And I think that was one of the challenges that, you know, I mean, I haven't played full-time since 2017. And I think since then we've really seen the length on the LPGA from the LPGA players increase a lot. But, you know, even at the tail end of it, you know, from when I first came on tour, I was definitely in the top 10 or 15 longest players. To, you know, probably by 2017 being just above average, because of the way I learned to play golf, it would have meant completely retooling my golf swing to start adding, speed to it because, you know, I never learned that way. No one taught me to swing at 100%. You know, you're always swinging within yourself because of the direction the ball was going to go in. Yeah. And how solid you were going to hit it. So it would have been a complete change in how I play golf. Had I even grown up 5 years later, I would have probably been forced to do that because I still wouldn't have been in the age of technology. But I would have
had to convert.
Yeah, I would have been young enough that I would have needed to start thinking about that.
Well, you mentioned sort of finishing up full-time in 2017, but as we come out of 2006, several victories still out there. You won the J Golf Phoenix LPGA International. That was your second win there in 2009. You won the HSBC Women's Champions at Tanamera in Singapore, and also that year the R.R. Donnelly LPGA Founders Cup, which I'll come back to with you. A couple of wins in 2013 at the ShopRite, which is a name everybody recognizes on that tour, and also the Honda Ladies Masters. You won the Honda Women's Australian Open at Victoria Golf Club in 2014, which I think was the last of your five wins there. And then a win at the Founders Cup by one over five players in 2014. So you had several more victories in you after that good year in 2006, but all good things come to an end at some point. So what kind of caused you to wind it down when you did?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, one in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Well, I didn't really wind down full playing until 2017, but, you know, my goal, once golf was announced into the Olympics, I think was that in 2010, I think it was announced, was to play at least full-time through to the Olympics and hopefully qualify for the Olympics, which If I have any disappointments in my career, that's probably up there in the top three because of not playing well enough in the last couple of years to make the team. Because I knew that was probably my only shot at making the Olympics. I didn't think by 2020 I'd still be playing full time, which I wasn't. I played full time one more year after that, and then I actually realized, I think, because I was fortunate enough not to have any injury, that, you know, I just was really burnt out. I'd never had that downtime that an injury would give you, and the desire to get back to playing golf. It was just 1 year rolled into the next, the next, the next, and then all of a sudden it was 2017. At the end of 2016, I was really disheartened with the game, and I thought, I'd commit to 2017 full time and see if I could turn that feeling around. And things just sort of didn't get much better. And I was really close at how I felt about the game. I could have just walked away from it, but I think I was probably old enough at the time to know that I was burnt out, and that golf had been so great to me that there's no way that I could leave the game the way I was feeling. And so I just decided to play part-time the next couple of years, which I actually really enjoyed, and got my love back for the game, and planned to do that in 2020, but obviously COVID ended that. And I probably had a neck injury, not a neck injury, but a wear and tear issue with my neck that I needed to take care of. And, once golf resumed and there was all those restrictions, I was like, that's not really why I'm playing. If I was 23 again, I would have been out there with bells on. But, part of my enjoyment of going back out on tour was to catch up with the people that I was missing seeing, and I wasn't going to get to do that. So, 2020 was also good for me because I realized I could survive without playing golf as well. So
there you go.
It sort of helped with that transition.
So Mike always says to me, there's one other part of all of these great champions that you always like to ask a question about, Bruce. So I'm going to ask you the question.
Okay.
You're the 79th World Golf Hall of Fame and major champion that we've spoken to in the last 2.5 years. What do you think your great players' winning percentages in playoffs?
Well, I know mine's not in the positive. I definitely lost more than I won. I know that, but I don't know. I don't know if that's a common thing or not. But yeah, definitely,
it is pretty common. It's about 42%, I think it is, of all the playoffs between all the great players have been able to win. So, I think what it does, it just shows you what a bit of a crapshoot it is in a playoff.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, if you look at, Hall of Famers' careers, there's lots of seconds that go along with the first as well. So usually some of those are in playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, that's true. We talked to Kathy Whitworth. What, 88 wins, 95 seconds.
Isn't that amazing?
And speaking of seconds, as we sort of spin down through your major career, we've talked about 7 wins, but you had some close calls. One of your playoff losses was to Sari Pack in the 2006 LPGA Championship at Bully Rock. You finished second the following year to Suzanne Pettersen. At the same place, so you probably like that golf course a little bit, but you don't always come out on top. And Avion 2014, you had a second. British Open 2009, you had a second to Catriona Matthew, who we're going to talk to next week on the show. Could have been a few more, I guess, huh? Woulda, shoulda, coulda?
Yeah, woulda, shoulda, coulda, but I probably won some that I shouldn't have won as well.
There you go.
I won't ask you to name one.
I don't know if I'd be able to name them off the top of my head, but I know for sure that I got lucky in a few of them.
Yeah, so you had a chance to play a little bit of senior stuff already. We talked at the top about the age for LPGA stuff being sort of 45 and you got to wait a little bit for the USGA. Do you plan on playing a little bit of the USGA stuff as well?
The legend stuff?
Yeah, well, yeah, like the USGA, the Women's Senior Open.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I've got a couple of birthdays to go before I get there. So I don't know of anyone ever that said that they're in a hurry to get to 50. So
No. Honest will take your time, right?
Yeah, I definitely think I will play, though, once I reach that age. But, I'm quite content playing a handful of times a year and then enjoying golf socially.
Yeah. Well, before we talk about some of the stuff you're involved in and passionate about today, Bruce, you just look through the various awards, honors, accolades that have been bestowed upon Corey Webb. Quite an incredible list.
It is. A couple of things that I notice is he's a member of the Order of Australia. That was in 2010. And then 2018, he got a special, became an officer of the Order of Australia, which is something that really says all of the great things and contributions that you've made to the sport in Australia. So congratulations on both them, from my standpoint anyhow.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. Those are definitely very, very special awards. And not, I don't think it, something that you set out to achieve in your life. Both occasions, I didn't know that my name had been put forward. So they were very, very nice surprises.
Yeah.
Of course, Hall of Fame induction, you mentioned the tournament at which you scored enough points, but that was sort of a technicality, was it? Because you had to play some more and then you probably had to get older.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, back then the rules were you had to be on tour for 10 years to qualify. And so I think I was 4.5 years in. It was a little time to wait. But, even being inducted when I did, I think, and getting inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame at 30, I think I would have appreciated and looked at my career as a whole better later in my life than in the heat of my career. I think I definitely understood the magnitude of what I had achieved, but I would have appreciated the honor even more if I had waited until probably now, or I think it's over 45 now. So, it is always better to look at your career when it's either almost or it's done or it's almost done. I think you have a way better perspective on it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. No question. 2016 LPGA William and Mousy Powell Award, among a whole list of others, Sports Australia Hall of Fame 2022.
Well, golf course architecture. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's golf course architecture has sort of been in my life since early on. In my late 90s, I got an opportunity to be a part of designing a golf course close to where I grew up, down near Proserpine. At Laguna Keys, David Graham had designed the first course there, and a new owner had come in and wanted a second course built. And because I was doing what I was doing on the world stage and also growing up in that neck of the woods, I was given the opportunity to do that. And it was a great experience. I saw the land as a rainforest, to the corridors cut, to the course shaped, and then unfortunately the owner went bankrupt, and that's where the golf course ended, and now it's an overgrown rainforest again. So, but I think that got my taste for it, and I knew it would be something that I would like to look into as I, got older and wasn't playing as much. And Ross Parrott and Peter Thompson. Well, Peter had always been such a lovely man and a great supporter of mine throughout my career. And
he could play a little too, couldn't he?
Yeah. Ross and Peter graciously asked me to be a part of their team for the Rio Olympic course bid for the Olympics in 2016. So that was really my not my next foray. I had a couple of others. I've actually been redesigning Townsville Golf Club with Bob Harrison for a number of years now. This was my next sort of jump into the business with the fam. And quite honestly, I enjoyed working with both of them right from the start. And they both, you know, had years and years and years of experience and, you know, trusted in me and knew that and really made me feel a part of the team. And I enjoyed that a lot. And we made it to the finals of that design competition and unfortunately didn't win it. But we went on and bid on a couple of other projects, one being Royal Pines that we didn't win, amazingly. But when Peter retired, I guess he had mentioned to Ross that he hoped one day that that we would work together. And in 2018, Ross and I put in a bid for Indooroopilly Golf Club, and we won out of 29 or 30 teams putting their names in the hat. So that was sort of where Parrot Web started. You know, COVID wasn't great for building our business, but you know, we're starting to get a little bit more traction now. So hopefully that's something that'll carry on for many years to come.
So Curry, tell us a little bit about your philanthropy endeavors. I know you have the Curry Web series with Golf Australia and also Spinal Cure in Australia. We'd like to know a little bit more about them.
Yeah, well, the Curry Web series is something that's been very special to me since we started it in 2007. The first scholarship winners came to the US Open in 2008, and it was always something that I wanted to do was find a way to give back to women's golf in Australia. My collaboration with Golf Australia has been something that I have loved since day one. And, you know, not only do the girls, the two girls that receive a scholarship get monetary support to help with golf travels and coaching, et cetera, but to me the highlight for them, but it definitely is for me, has been having them over to the U.S. for a week. And while I was playing in the majors, they either attended the U.S. Open or the Women's PGA. Those weeks were really fun. I think, full circle moment in 2019, staying in a house with the current scholarship winners, Becky Kay and Grace Kim. Grace now is out playing on the LPGA. Past scholarship winners Hannah Green and Sue Oh were staying in the house, as well as Stacey Keating, who is Stacey Peters, she is now who is staying in the house. Stacey was one of the first scholarship winners. So all staying together, and Hannah ended up winning the KPMG Women's PGA. So very, very special moment. Nice. Yeah. So I've really enjoyed my involvement. I don't think I'm not a coach by any means, but I love mentoring the girls, and I don't think until you actually are asked about your experiences do you really feel like you have much to give. But I've really enjoyed that part of it over the years. And really being a part of watching all the young next Australian generation of women who are going to fly the flag on all the tours around the world. So it's just to be a part of their careers and watch their careers unfold to whatever they might be. I've gotten a lot out of that, and I'm pretty sure that the girls have as well. So that's been really important. And as far as spinal care, I've been very involved in the U.S. with the Christopher Reeve Foundation. That was really my first foray into being a part of the cure for paralysis. And obviously that stems to my relationship with Calvin Haller and him becoming a quadriplegic when I was 16. So, I played an outing on Monday, and it was actually the Christopher Reeve or the Reeve Foundation golf day. And that's still a big part of my life. And, I think what the foundation stands for, they're definitely searching for a cure. And I've been a part of the foundation since 1998. This is probably the most exciting time there's been in the research part. I think a cure to paralysis is as close as it's ever been. So that's been really exciting. But also, while Dana Reeve was alive, she understood that besides finding a cure for paralysis, it was really important to support the newly paralyzed people, as well as their support family and friends, whoever that they had as their support into this new life, and to help them navigate through all the challenges that there was. And obviously, my experience being involved with Calvin was how much it changed not only his life, but his wife's life and his children's lives. And that's been a really important part of my life.
Yeah, well, thanks for sharing some of the fulfilling work that you're involved in. I think before we wrap up, Bruce, as you know, during the last year of us almost exclusively doing interviews with the Lady Pros, we've come to learn a lot more than we knew a year ago about the LPGA and how it came to be. And I can think back to Gloria Arrett suggesting to us that we look at a book by Liz Kahn on the 50-year history of the LPGA, and from that we've used as a resource. Of course, we've got other things that we've learned from as well, and then through Liz Kahn learning about a documentary that was released in 2016 celebrating the 13 founders of the LPGA Tour. It's called The Founders, and our guest today had a big part in making that happen. We thought, Kara, you'd tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you guys if it weren't for our 13 founders and all the women that came before us. So in 2014, a documentary film company off their own bat had heard about the story of our founders. And it really was a story that should have been told many, many years before it was. But off their own bat, they wanted to make a documentary movie about the story of the LPGA and how it got started with the 13 women that started it. They were at the Founders Cup, named for our founders, to celebrate our past and then give back to our future with the donations of that tournament, the going to the LPGA USGA Junior Girls Golf Program. And so they were at that event to interview certain players that they wanted to be in the documentary. And I was asked to be a part of it. And I was talking to them about how I thought this was long overdue and, thanking them for making it. And they had just mentioned that they were still trying to raise money to finish it. They literally were doing this on their own. It wasn't, the LPGA hadn't asked them to do it. The USGA hadn't asked, they simply thought it was a story worth telling. And fast forward to Sunday, I have a come from behind win. And as was sort of early tradition in that event, I think it started, I won the first event, the first Founders Cup, and the first year we played for no purse, and the winner got to donate $200,000 to a charity of their choice. And back then, and the rest of the money was going to the LPGA, USGA Junior Girls Golf. But fast forward to when I won in 2014, I think Stacey Lewis won the year prior to me, and when she won, she donated $50,000 to Junior Girls Golf, and So I was aware of, you know, it sort of trended that that was what happened with the winners after we started playing for actual money. And so I thought, you know, I would have to, you know, I should, not have to, I should donate money to the LPGA USGA Junior Girls Golf Program. But while I was on the 18th waiting for the presentation, I looked up and I saw the documentary filmmakers up there. And so I decided to split my donation and donate half of it to their cause, which, you know, created the biggest cheer from them, and started a little bit more traction for the film. And Stacey Lewis also ended up donating some money to the cause as well, and the LPGA came on board, and the documentary got done, and you know, I just think it's, you know, now especially we lost Marlene Hagee this year, who was our our last founder to pass. You know, I was fortunate enough that when I first came on tour, there was still enough of the founders alive, and then they were still relatively young and were traveling out to a few events a year. So, you know, I got to experience that and hear their stories from them. You know, they'd sit in the locker room and tell their stories, and everyone sat down and listened when they spoke. And, you know, it's a great piece of footage to have, so that the next generation of LPGA players coming along understand what we've worked so hard for all these years. You know, generation after generation have tried to carry on what the our LPGA founders started.
So I have one little postscript story for you that you might get a kick out of.
Okay.
68 years ago, I played at the Lakes Golf Club with Marlene Hagee and Kel Nagel in a golf tournament.
Wow.
And we're sitting having lunch together, and she said to Kel, who at that time was 34 and I was 17, she said, "Oh, so are we playing with your son today?" And Kel said, "No, he's not my son. He's 17 year old. How old do you think I am?" She said, "Oh, I don't know." He said, "Oh, I'm 34. She said, "Well, so what? That works." Yeah, so that was a long time ago. It was sad to see her pass, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as you said, long overdue, and I think what's nice, not knowing how this happened behind the scenes, perhaps the notoriety of the documentary helping, but in June of next year, in conjunction with the U.S. Open and in conjunction with the opening of the new World Golf Hall of Fame Pinehurst, we will have the rest of the founders inducted. Yeah. And so that includes Marlene's sister, Alice. It includes Betty Danoff, Helen Detweiler, Helen Hicks, Opal Hill, Sally Sessions, and Shirley Spork.
Isn't that great?
Again, long overdue. And I think probably held up just because women are women, and that our founders were as big competitors as any group of women, and they wanted our Hall of Fame to be about how you were as a player. I really feel the contribution of all 13 women, is worthy of Hall of Fame status.
And they each have stories worthy of a movie.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, that's very true.
So, Carrie, you've been wonderful with your time today, but we do not let our guests go away without answering three questions.
Okay.
And I'm going to let Mike ask you the first question.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much for this honor. So, Carrie, you're 19 years old again, going to be a professional golfer, but you know then what you know now. What would you have done differently?
I don't know if I would have done much, but I think I would have told myself to take enough time to smell the roses, but don't stay there and enjoy it too much. Like, I know that I achieved what I achieved because I probably didn't take the time to think about it, but I think I would have loved to have appreciated a little bit more while I was in the heat of it. And the other thing I would have said was, even when you get to being the best in the world, don't mess with your golf swing. Just stick to what you know and work on everything else. Work on your mind, work on your short game, work on your putting.
Okay, second question. I'm going to give you one mulligan. Where would you take it?
One mulligan. Yeah, I know where it is.
Everybody does.
Going through all the years. 2014 Evian Masters, the Evian, sorry. It was the major then. I had a one-shot lead playing the last. The 18th was a par four then, and I probably hit one of the purest four irons I've ever hit and was probably a foot or two from hitting it to 3 or 4 feet, and it just sort of hung up on the left fringe. And then Hooju Kim, right behind me, sticks her shot to, and she was the one that was one shot behind me, she hits her shot to 15 feet below the hole. My mulligan would be, instead of bellying a wedge from the fringe, I would have putted it. And I probably would have taken a little more time to think about how fast that that shot was going to be. The speed definitely caught me by surprise, but I think if I putted it, I wouldn't have hit it as far past as I did when I bellied the wedge. So that would be my mulligan. I don't know if the outcome would be any different, because she made the putt for birdie and I would have still had to make a par for a playoff. So going on my playoff record, you never know. I might have still finished second, but I would have liked that shot over again.
Yeah, fair enough. Bruce, you take the last one.
I get to do two again, do I? Mm-hmm. How would Carrie Webb like to be remembered?
I think I would love to be remembered for I guess not only the player that I was, but how I played the game and how much I respected the game of golf and how much I gave back.
And that's wonderful. Thanks. It really has been a pleasure. We both, Mike and I, have looked forward to this for so long. And we again thank you for your time, Carrie. It's been a great interview. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Mike. It was a great trip down memory lane, and you definitely gathered more stats than I knew there was. So it was nice to be reminded of all that good golf.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.